Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer, and this is U2. Now, is U2 Christian rock? Well, consider this. Earlier this year, lead singer Bono was a featured speaker at the National Prayer Breakfast, where he shared the stage with George W. Bush. And lately, Episcopal churches across the U.S. have begun holding U2 Eucharists, church services with big-screen TVs and sing-alongs to the band's songs. Still, U2's relationship to Christianity is not so black and white. Joining us today to explore some of the contradictions in U2 and faith is Christian Sharon, Associate Director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture and author of the book One Step Closer, Why U2 Matters to Those Seeking God. Christian, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Also joining us again is Joe Levy, the deputy managing editor at Rolling Stone, which profiled U2 back in December. Joe, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Christian, let me start by asking, I guess, a pretty simple question. Ask most U2 fans if they think U2 is a Christian rock band. They'll say no. What do you say?
No. I went through last night on iTunes all the collection of Christian music that they list there, and there's no U2 songs listed at all. So I think by standard of the industry and by most people's imagination, U2 doesn't fit in that category.
Do you think they should?
No, I think what they've really tried to do is creatively be a band with convictions that are rooted in the Christian faith, and that's something not very many bands have done. Mm-hmm. And so they deserve, I think, a distinctive category.
Well, Joe, it seems to me that, you know, as with any category, you quickly get into semantics. I mean, Christian rock could mean a bunch of guys who happen to be Christian and are playing rock, but...
But generally, Christian rock in the world of rock and roll does not mean that. It's a specific thing. It's faith-based music, and the bands, well, it would be an exaggeration to say they're all boring. I should perhaps say that many of them are boring to me. They tend to be more parochial than U2, mm-hmm. and definitely more evangelical than U2. Mm. And they very much believe in the Christian church. And U2 may believe in Christianity, but not necessarily in the Christian church. And we're talking here about bands like, oh, I don't know, Jars of Clay, perhaps Creed, who have certainly Christian undertones to their music and certainly were embraced by that world. But there are Christian rock festivals, massive festivals in the Midwest. And while many of the people there may appreciate U2, U2 is not going to show up and play that festival. Mm. They may be Christian and they do rock, but right. They are not Christian rock.
But Jars of Clay is, and they had sort of a, almost really I would call this a crossover hit. The song Flood was actually shown on MTV some years ago. So this would be an example of Christian rock. All right, the band Jars of Clay, not only an example of Christian rock, but one of the more successful examples of the genre. We're speaking with Joe Levy from Rolling Stone and with Christian Sharon, who wrote the book One Step Closer, Why U2 Matters to Those Seeking God. So, Christian, we began with Mysterious Ways from Achtung Baby, the 1991 album by U2. it seems like that song, songs like I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, there's an onion effect here where you can peel off different layers of meaning. And if you're looking for the spirituality, you can certainly find it without too much trouble.
That's right. And Mysterious Ways is a great example of the complexity of U2 songs and one of the reasons why they don't fit the Christian rock genre because of that complexity. So that song has all kinds of layers, starting with just a layer of sexuality, which you won't find in very many Christian rock songs. But U2 tries to hold together, well, how is sexuality not also spirituality?
Right.
And so in that song, you see this wisdom literature from the Old Testament, which many Christians don't pay attention to, drawn out and made into a beautiful song that can be about a lover and can be about this image of the Holy Spirit in a sort of feminine persona.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is certainly would not be a surprising concept to a Hindu, for example, where
right.
there's a long tradition of kind of semi-erotic poetry that is also kind of ecstatic spiritual poetry.
That's right. And the world religions generally have had a significant place for divine feminine. And I think U2 is an interesting case because here you have this group of four men in this power rock band, and yet at the same time, almost all of their organization are women.
Uh-huh.
And so they have this this way of honoring, I think, through the way that they talk about God, this sort of element of the divine feminine.
All right. Now, Joe was saying before there are these kind of, you know, big concert festivals
right.
of Christian rock and that U2 would not appear at one of those. If they did, what kind of reaction would they get for a song like I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, which seems to be as much about doubt as it is about faith?
I think different Christians respond to U2 differently. There's a group of Christians who I would describe as on the margins of the church or frustrated in various ways with the church. And they have doubts, and they live as modern people in the world, and they see the awful things happening in the world, and so they want songs that admit doubt. Then there's other Christians who fear doubt and have what I would describe as a more fragile faith and worry that if they admit doubt, then somehow God will not bless them or not be present for them, so they have to ignore that. So that group of Christians, I think, is more nervous when they hear a quote, Christian band, admit that doubt might be a part of our faith.
Joe Levy from Rolling Stone. Christian writes in his book that the song I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For caused a certain group of Christians to write them off as lost. And it seems that at various points in U2's career, one group or another has sort of, you know, they've done this kind of balancing act. You know,
well, there's always somebody writing U2 off as lost. Actually, they thrive on it. To be perfectly honest, they enjoy making mistakes so they can win back their audience. And it's a slight exaggeration, but I think there's a good deal of truth to it. I'm not actually familiar with the Christians who would have written off U2 because of that song and because of the doubt expressed in it. I think U2 does a very good job of expressing their faith. And also leaving their songs open to the portion of their audience who does not share in mm-hmm. their faith. And I think they do a very good job of packing multi-layered meanings, as we've been saying, into their songs. Christian's book is extremely convincing that many of the song lyrics proceed directly from biblical verse. Very, very convincing on the effect that the Psalms have on U2's work. And very interesting in that regard, and Bono has said as much. He said that the Bible is sustenance for him, both literary sustenance and spiritual sustenance. But very rarely has it been as clear to me as when I was reading through Christian's book.
All right, the book is called One Step Closer, Why U2 Matters to Those Seeking God. This song, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, is a good example of U2. You can take it for its message, or you can just take it as a fine piece of pop music writing. we're talking about the band U2. Are they Christian rock? And if not, then what are they? And how have they managed to walk this particular musical slash spiritual tightrope so successfully for so long? My guests are Christian Scharon, who is himself a Lutheran pastor and teaches practical theology and congregational studies at Yale Divinity School. He's the author of the book One Step Closer, Why U2 Matters to Those Seeking God. And Joe Levy is, doesn't have a title quite so grand as pastor, but he is deputy managing editor at Rolling Stone, which is good enough for us. Joe, you've been out drinking with Bono, not to put too fine a point on it. The guy is...
I've been in the room and beverages have been consumed several times, yes.
So, I mean, he's not a choir boy.
He's not. He's a man who can walk into a Manhattan restaurant after closing hour and bottles of wine are mysteriously produced, even though it is illegal. Yes, that does happen. That can happen at 4 or 5 in the morning.
And Christian, your book, the subtitle, Why U2 Matters to Those Seeking God, is this aimed at those who are outside the church but are kind of feeling some kind of lack and are searching for something? Or is this aimed at the people who perhaps are, you know, kind of feel themselves to be right down the center of the tradition and who would say that because Bono can walk into a restaurant after hours and get wine flowing, that he's not really a Christian? Which group are you aiming at?
Both. In the one way, I wanted to write this book for teenagers I was working with who thought Coolio made up the lyric, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. They were shocked to discover that in the Psalms. And so there's a whole group of young people who just think the church is either boring or out of touch with the kind of concerns they have. And I wanted to use an avenue of the imagination of their love for popular culture and music to invite them into a conversation about the Christian faith and what a life of faith might look like that's more interesting to them than what they often see.
Well, now, I mentioned these U2 Eucharists that a number of Episcopal churches have used. It seems to me, and I don't want to say this in any kind of pejorative sense at all, that U2's music in those cases is being used almost as a marketing tool. What do you think about that?
I think it's certainly partly being used as a marketing tool. There was one in Providence that was written up on the AP Wire, and the priest there said, we're dying as a church, and we need to find ways to be relevant. And so certainly that's true, but there's also this sort of, I would call it organic rising up from inside the church of people who grew up with U2 and for whom U2 describes faith convictions and doubts that they share. And so there's a sense that they're just tired of going to worship and singing songs they don't resonate with, and they want to create a worship service where they can sing, I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I want to jump in and also say that U2 themselves use their music as a marketing tool. It's just that they tend to be marketing peace, economic justice, access to health care for those with AIDS in Africa, and they very much believe in using their music to market these ideas to their audience and the world. But I think that, Christian, you would agree that they very much feel that these ideas come out of their experience of Christianity, if not the Christian church. One of the most interesting things Bono says in this November cover story we did last year is of the evangelical movement in the United States, he says, I'm very wary of faith without action.
Mm-hmm.
So he certainly had his action, I believe, comes in a large part from his faith.
Yeah.
Now, what is his religious background?
Born to a Protestant and Catholic household in Ireland during a time when Protestants and Catholics did not mix in Ireland. His mother was Protestant.
That's right.
His father was a Catholic. He has said that organized religion left him cold. As a child and as a young adult, yet he's also said that there were people in his life at that point who were ecstatically religious. He had the father of a friend who he describes as something like a Pentecostal preacher at the dinner table. So there was certainly that in his life.
And Christian, in the course of writing this book and sort of following a quarter century arc of U2's music, would you say that the kind of the spiritual element and U2's attitude towards religion, whether formal or informal, has become more or less overt in their music over the years?
I feel like it's been a constant, and it's been a constant partly because It's a part of their sense of what matters in life. It really is, I think, a grounding point for them. Bono refers to it as an anchor, but it's changed in its mode of expression. So when they entered the 90s, they really did take on a sort of masked approach, if you want to call it this, a playful approach to doing these songs. So they wouldn't have done necessarily the kind of religious songs that they did in the 90s, in the 80s. So they have experimented with different modes.
And then there was the album October, which I guess was their second record.
Right.
And I recall very clearly, you know, not being the only person to think, wow, they're sort of becoming like a religious band. I mean, they seem to, after the first album, Boy, you know, and the first hit, I Will Follow, which had that nice duality of meaning.
Right.
It seemed like October was a little more explicitly religious.
Yeah.
And there was some muttering being heard among fans.
That album maybe is most representative of that moment of crisis early in their lives when they were in this Christian community that, in one sense, was incredibly prophetic and powerful and was trying to figure out, well, how do we live differently in the world? But at the same time, they experience this community they're very involved and connected to saying, you have to choose. Is mm-hmm. it the Christian faith or
this
is it rock
was,
and roll?
This was the study group they were involved
yeah,
in?
Yeah, the Shalom Fellowship. That was about the same time as October came out. And you can the last song of that album, Bono singing the song, What Do You Want From Me? You know, you can hear the angst that they were experiencing and the lyrics that they were singing at that time.
Joe, you were talking before about, you know, the fact that sometimes Bono's lyrics are taken whole cloth out of the Bible, out of the Psalms. What is the song 40?
Well, Christian's going to be able to cite you chapter and verse on this because he'll actually tell you which chapter and which verse it's from. But it is, in fact, Psalm 40, is it not?
It is. With they nipped a chorus from Psalm 6. So it's a little bit of a cobbling together of two.
So it's a sampler.
Singing one psalm but sampling from another.
Right, right. This is actually from the third album by the band U2. The song is called 40. The song is called 40, based on Psalm 40 and a little bit of Psalm 6, and it's music from U2's third record called War. Joe Levy, the psalm text aside, what's the contemporary message of this song? Is it about Northern Ireland and the time of the Troubles?
It's about many things. It's certainly about that. When used in concert, the refrain, how long to sing this song, is often appended to Sunday Bloody Sunday, is it not?
It's actually a lyric from Sunday Bloody Sunday as well, which is the first song on that album. So you get this sort of bookend psalm experience on that album.
But generally speaking, what they're addressing there is a worldwide state of war. You two can never be accused of keeping things simple or small.
Right.
So they're by no means only limiting their questions to the troubles in Northern Ireland. They are talking about the world itself. And, you know, it's very interesting. You mentioned where these songs come from. We were talking before about Bono's religious experience as a kid. Another thing he told Rolling Stone was that to him, religious questions and religious messages as a kid were coming to him through the songs he listened to.
Mm-hmm.
And a song he cited was Dylan's Blowing in the Wind, How Many Roads Must a Man Walk Down? You can really hear that kind of questioning intent in the song we were just listening to.
What struck me in the Rolling Stone interview was that he referred numerous times to John Lennon, an atheist, as someone who he felt was a very prayerful kind of writer.
He refers to Lennon's work as spiritual, which it certainly was, and he says that it was like an intimate conversation as though someone were whispering about God in his ear when he would listen to John Lennon's music on headphones as a child.
Right. We're talking about U2 with Joe Levy, who's deputy managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine, and with Christian Scharin, who is from the Yale Divinity School and the author of One Step Closer, Why U2 Matters to Those Seeking God. Christian, one of our listeners called in to remind us of the story of Leslie Phillips, who now records under the name Sam Phillips, but she went from being a sort of Christian rocker, you know, a Christian singer-songwriter, to someone who's very much in the secular world. I guess the thing with U2 is you can't draw a kind of narrative arc through their career like that. They've somehow managed, as you suggest in your book, to be both a rock band and to be important to
right.
people who are looking for something more than just a rock band.
That's right, and especially for people who see them in concert, there's this sense that they've always had about concerts that people ought to be changed by coming to a U2 show, not just leaving with the same feeling that they came before, leaving not necessarily feeling happy. Sometimes you leave a U2 show and you're disturbed because of the issues that they raise, the cultural critique that they bring about and the creativity of their show, but nonetheless lifted and challenged and inspired that not only can you make a difference as you go out and live your life, you ought to.
Mm-hmm. Does that, Joe, almost inevitably set Bono up with a bullseye on his back for some people, the fact that he is so out there, you know, so much in evidence at the forefront of these various mostly liberal causes?
Yes, I suppose. I mean, there certainly were times literally where it set him up with a bullseye on his back because his life was threatened.
Right.
And these are real things that someone in his position needs to consider. But that said, he's often criticized. He's criticized, very often was criticized in the early days for being too preachy. The famous moment, of course, on Rattle and Hum, the live record, when he asks if he's bugging us, are we bugging you? For many of us, the answer was yes. I like the later U2, the somewhat ironic U2, mm-hmm. when they are less preachy. It appeals more to me, mm-hmm. and therefore I become more open to their messages, both spiritual and political, rather than the overtly preachy U2 who were telling us that our lives could be changed by three chords and the truth. Now, it's a very stirring message, but there is something almost too earnest about it. And having been accused of being too earnest, they went away and became very unearnest, you know, at the time of Achtung Baby.
Mm-hmm. Christian, in their latest album, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, there is a song called Crumbs from Your Table. Mm-hmm. In your book, you suggest that this is basically a parable.
Right. And it draws on some of the strongest images in Scripture about the relationship between the rich and the poor. This story about the rich man and Lazarus at his gate in the Gospel of Luke is a powerful story about what happens when someone in a position of wealth isn't willing to consider the well-being of the one who's at his gate. And Bono talks about living in an internet age and in a media age. Our neighbor that we're supposed to love isn't just anymore the one at our gate, like that in that parable. But now our neighbor is across the world in Africa. And if we're not responding to that neighbor, then somehow we're missing the place where God is and is calling us to be.
Well, now, you know, we've been talking a lot about multiple layers of meaning. Is he also kind of coming to grips with his own celebrity, fame, wealth, and how he has to deal with that?
I think he's been struggling with that in songs for a long time. And Crumbs from Your Table, in one sense, is just they say at certain points that this is the only song they've ever written drunk. I'm not sure about that. but Larry Mullen says, I can't remember where this song came from, and that's probably true. But there's an anger in this song, and so they are really admitting that they have to speak clearly.
We've been speaking with Christian Scharin, author of the book One Step Closer, Why U2 Matters to Those Seeking God, and to Joe Levy of Rolling Stone magazine. Gentlemen, to the two of you, thank you for joining us this afternoon on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And if you'd like to email us, we'd like to hear from you. Our email address is soundcheck@wnyc.org. Yeah. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Every day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. So please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.